Vision recorder. Okay. We have been spending some time on Perek Yud and the main campaigns of David against. Second, I just need to move this over. Give me 1 second. Sorry, I'm just dealing with technical stuff still. There we go. Yeah, the main campaign of David in the north, which starts with a war against Ammon, followed because of the events related to the effort of David to reach. Can everybody hear me? Yes? Can everybody
yes.
hear me?
Yeah, okay. Yes.
The effort of David to reach out to the king of Ammon after the death of his father, that ended up in the shameful embarrassment of his troops. So he sends you off to war against Ammon. That war, if you remember the details of it, that war ended up with Ammon calling in reinforcements from Aram. So suddenly Yoav and his army found themselves surrounded on both sides by the Ammon on one side, Aram on the other, splits his forces, sends a small fighting force to take out the army of Aram, a larger fighting force with his brother to take out the army of Ammon. That battle ends in some sort of a stalemate. Then the forces of Aram regrouped in the north. They gather together. David sends the entire army of Israel under his command up to the north into the area of Chelam or the Golan Heights, Bashan, Salmon. And there, if we go to the end of the parak, there's a major campaign in the north, and Vayanos Aram is defeated together with his army, and all of the kings who had joined forces with Hadad-Ezer, king of one of the Aramean kings, nikfulifnei Israel, vayashlimu et Yisrael ve'avdum, and they make peace with Israel. So that's where the story ended. We then digressed a little bit into the world of Tehillim to see one of the dramatic prakim written about this story, in which David uses the model of Shirat David as a kind of Shirat Devorah as a kind of paradigm to the notion of a divine revelation of God's power and presence in the midst of battle, even suggesting that the victory was achieved in a similar fashion, in the same way Devorah had achieved victory over Sisera and his chariots by virtue of rain that was unexpected and mudslides and taking out the wheels and the chariots. Similarly, David describes in Perek Samach this kind of rain falling and mudsliding and the triumph over the armies of the enemy. And describing all of this in the battle in Chelam or Bashan, Gavnunim, etc. He uses the expression Zes Sinai Mipnei Hashem Elokei Yisrael. This is comparable to the revelation at Sinai, a phrase that is borrowed from Shirat Devorah as well. The last thing we looked at, just to kind of do a quick summary, was the Midrashim on that same Perek. And this was as much a nod to Shavuos as it is to the Perek itself. Let's go one more source up here. I'll pull that source page up again. In the Medrash about this particular parak, which is a famous Medrash because it pulls together the story about Tavor and Carmel and all the mountains where there was some kind of revelation of God's presence. Tavor, Carmel, Bashan, Tavor being Devorah's description of the battle and the revelation of God in that battle, Bashan being our case, the revelation of God by us, and then Har Carmel, of course, is a story of Eliyahu. The Medrash describes these mountains having a conversation about where Torah should be given, and of course God chooses Har Sinai. One version of the Medrash is that God chose Arsinoe because of its humility. That's the more famous one. And the other is that God chose Arsinoe because never on Arsinoe had idol worship ever taken place. It was a purer mountain than these other experiences. But in all cases, the Medrash picks up on the experience of Har Carmel, of Har Bashan, as a connection to Har Sinai backwards, describing Har Sinai in the language of Har Bashan, Har Gavnunim, Har Bashan, and one of the interesting things about Shisha Dvarim Nikru'ulo, that Har Sinai has six names, Har Bashan, Har Gavnunim, Har Chamad, right, different names, but these are all names that are descriptions of Harei HaGolan or Har Bashan, not Har Sinai. In other words, the Medrash is working off 180 degrees from the Medrash, from the text. The text used Har Sinai to describe the revelation on Har Tavor and on Har Bashan. The Medrash uses the experience of Har Bashan and Har Tavor to describe Har Sinai. So it's actually mirror, they're coming in opposite directions, which only, I think, strengthens the notion that Chazal were aware, this is a classic Midrashic methodology, Chazal were aware that the pshat of the perek is about Har Bashan. The drash was to take that same experience and apply it back to Har Sinai. I don't know if I mentioned this in last week, but one of the more humorous pieces of the story is that at least according to some sources, they point to this medrash as the source for the minhag of eating milchaks on Shavuos. Because one of the names given to Har Bashan is Har Gavnunim, which in this particular source translates from the word gvina. So Har Gavnunim, Har Sinai is called Har Gavnunim because we eat milchaks on Shavuos. Clearly, that's not the pshat. Pshat is Har Gavnunim means a multi-peaked giben adak, like a hunchback person, right, is peaks in the mountains of Harei HaGolan. But nonetheless, I thought that was just be humorous, a little bit of an aside to Chag HaShavua. And so more or less, this pulls together the idea that the war, is a moment of revelation, that if the whole idea of battle is of revelations, that life and death hang in the balance, and when you emerge victorious, the acknowledgement has to go to the Ribbono Shel Olam for his aid and his assistance in the battle. That's sort of at the core of what Bitachon is about. And so Har Tavor, Devorah, David is famous for it. Shirat David is another famous example. I'm not going to spend time now going through Shirat David. It's a worthwhile exercise, but you see it there too. Kind of, on the one hand, he describes the battlefield, and on the other hand, he describes God's revelation and presence and the feeling, the strength of the malachim, guiding his hand and guiding every arrow to its target. So you get that sense that the moments of greatest revelation are, or the greatest feeling of God's presence, are the moments when life and death is in the balance and we are in greatest danger, and we emerge victorious, and hence the mitzvah of hoda'ah, of arba'a she'tzrichim l'hodot, bekata gomel, korban toda, at those moments of experiencing life and death, challenging experiences that we then emerge from and acknowledge God's presence. That's what the revelation at the battlefield is about. On a much broader scale, since we just finished Yom Ha'atzmaut, the famous Perek Kuf Zayin. I don't know if we ever talked about that. You ever talk about the Hillel and Kuf Zayin? Tehillim Kuf Zayin is the parak of Tehillim that plays two roles. It is the foundation of the mitzvah of Birkat Gomel, the four categories of people who are obligated to give thanks. And it was chosen as the perek which we read through at the beginning of Ma'ariv of Leil Yom Ha'atzmaut, the Tefillah Chagigit. And the reason for that connection is because, on the one hand, the perek talks about Hodu Lashem Kitov, to give hoda of thanks to God, and it talks about the different experiences. Tohu b'midbar, if somebody's walking through the wilderness and crosses the desert, is one example of somebody who, in a moment of trouble, hunger, thirst, vayitzaku el Hashem, they cry to God in their distress, and God saves them by bringing them to their city or their destination. Their obligation is to give hodas, to give thanks. Yodula Hashem chazdov v'niflotav livnei adam. They should give thanks to God for his wondrous deeds. That's one example. Another example, kizbiya nefesh shokekav, somebody who is longing, is thirst, is hungry. Yoshev choshech v'tzamavet, he's sitting in darkness. Asirei oni ubazel, bound in affliction and iron, which is the example of somebody who is imprisoned. And in their imprisonment, they cry out to God, vayitzaku el Hashem, and God saves them. Yotziyei michoshech v'tzamavet, God saves them from darkness and the shadow of death. They will give thanks to God, yodu l'Hashem chazdo v'niflotav livnei adam. Another example, kishibre daltot nechoshet, evili miderech pish'am, kol ochel tita'ev nafsham, a person who is sick, who is craving food, who's not well, then they will cry out to God and he will save them, and they will give thanks to God after yishlach t'vavah yirpa'em, after God heals them. That's the case of somebody who is sick and who is healed. And the last case is yordei hayam ba'oniyot, one who goes across the sea in ships. Similarly, there is a storm, God, they will cry out to God, vayitzaku el Hashem, God will save them, yakem sarad d'mama, he will calm the waters of the sea, and then yodu l'Hashem chazdo v'niflotav livnei adam. So these are the four cases in the perek that are identified as by the Gemara as four cases that obligate a person to recite Birkat Gomel, Arba'a Shetzrichim Lehodot. But the pshat of the perek is that these four cases are actually subsets of Yomu Gulei Hashem Asher Ga'alam Miyad Tzar U'me'aratzot Kibtzam Mimizrach Mimarav Mitzafon U'miyam. These are four sets of examples of people who cross the sea and cross the desert and emerge from the wilderness and emerge from captivity in order to return to their land in the process of kibbutz goliot as part of the redemption of Israel. So the pshat of the perek is that these are people who cross the sea to get to Israel, who cross the desert to get to Israel, who emerge from illness in order to return home to their land, who have to emerge from captivity in order to return to the land of Israel. And the whole perek is talking about kibbutz goliot. And hence it's chosen as the tefillah for Yom HaAtzma'ut. The perek is clearly talking about the rebuilding of the land of Israel. But it's also this idea that these are moments of great danger. And moments of great danger, crossing the sea, crossing the desert, being sick, being imprisoned, when one emerges from it, one recognizes the hand of God in that experience. And hence, Yodul Hashem Chazdo, they have to give Hoda'a. And that's more or less the theme of Tehillim, the theme of David, in that these are moments in the battlefield that are of significant danger to the individual. And when they emerge victorious, both individually and nationally, they have to give thanks, they have to give Hoda'a. So that's more or less where we ended up, Perek Samach of Tehillim. Kuf Zayin of Tehillim is the same theme, and Perek Yud, more or less completed. Okay, that was a long summary with a few additional points of where we were at last week. I'm going to close that up.
And Rabbi, just a point. Those of us that are saying Tehillim every day, on the Luach, we're saying Per Kuf Zayin and Kuf Chet today. So it's interesting how you brought that all in.
Kuf Chet is today?
Kuf Zayin and Kuf Chet, according to the Luach, for those of us that say it from Neshe, that follow the Luach,
that's very interesting. I don't know if we're going to get to it today, but actually on my source page for today is Perek Kuf Chet.
Okay.
I don't know if we're going to get to it, but it just happens to be interesting that that's the, that I did not know that. All right.
I just want to mention it.
Appreciate that. All right. So more or less, that's what we were up to in Perek Yud. All of this are kind of one half a pasuk in this Perek. And that one pasuk describes the victory over the forces of Aram, a victory which literally changes the landscape of the land of Israel, because David now conquers this whole region of the land of Israel. we're now going to go back to Perek Chet. Perek Chet is the Perek that we skipped. Remember when we first started this discussion, we saw this, we went after Perek Zion in the story of the building of the Mikdash. We went to Perek Chet, we looked at it, we said there's a bunch of stuff here that doesn't seem to make any sense. All of these battles mentioned in Perek Chet are mentioned again in Perek Yud. So we learned through Perek Tet first, which is the story of Mephibosheth, and then we went to Perek Yud, in which we've studied this story, the two campaigns of David and Yoav against Ammon and Aram in depth. Now we have to go back to Perek Chet and relearn it based on the assumption that from a chronological perspective, it's describing the same events that we have in Perek Yud, but on a much broader, sort of from a much higher vantage point. All right, so we're going back to Perek Chet. So just, I want to reiterate, we're going backwards in time. We are now going back to a parak we had looked at before, but not studied. The battle with the Plishtim was a battle much earlier, even before the conversation with God about the building of the Mikdash. When after David comes to Yerushalayim, there's a battle with the Plishtim. This is the third of the three campaigns against the Plishtim. We've talked about that before. The city of Gat is the sort of the main capital city of the Plishtim, and David captures it, thereby ending the Philistine threat in the land of Israel altogether. Bayach et Moav. He smote Moav. He measured them with a line, forcing them, he made them lie down on the ground. Two lines put to death, one line kept alive, killed 2/3 of the population. Whatever that means. And Moav became servants to David and brought presents and loyal subjects of the kingdom of David. Vayach David et Hadadezer ben Rehov Melech Tzoba. David also smote Hadadezer. That, by the way, is the same Hadadezer from Perek Yud. Just to be clear, right? That's the same Perek. Go back to Perek Yud, and Vayishlach Hadadezer v'yotzei et Aram. Same Hadadezer. Vayach David et Hadadezer ben Rehov Melech Tzoba. When he went to establish dominion over the Euphrates. So that's probably your reference to David. As David smites the armies of Aram, he expands dominion of the land of Israel or the kingdom of Israel all the way up to the Euphrates. And in so doing, he defeats the king of Aram Tzova by the name of Hadadezer. Vayokod David mimenu elef ushvamiot parashim v'esim elef ish ragli. He took from him 1,700 horsemen, 20,000 soldiers. Vayakir David et kol arechev, and he vayakir laakor sus is to hamstring a horse. What does hamstring a horse means? Right, to sever the hamstring in order to make it, or to maim the horse so it can't run.
That's pretty cruel.
Excuse me.
That's pretty cruel.
In today's world, it's considered pretty cruel. In David's world, it was considered pretty standard as a way of removing the ability of a horse to be used as a vehicle of war. It's actually a requirement in the Torah, actually. It's susehem te'aker. It's a mitzvah, it's a obligation in the Torah to essentially, it's put it this way. In today's world, the equivalent would be you capture an enemy tank or plane, disable it. That's essentially the same model. Today's world is considered a cruel, but in the world of Tanakh, it was a necessary step in order to eliminate the power of the army. And he left only 100 chariots in reserve. Vatava Aram Damesek. He comes to Aram Damesek. Remember, this is our map. So we're moving up the map. Aram Tzova is up here. Aram Damesek is over here. Aram Rehov, Ma'acha. These are all Aramean city-states. Vatava Aram Damesek. La'azor la'hadadezer melech Tzova. So Aram Damesek comes to assist Hadadezer in this campaign. Vayach David ba'aram esim mishnayim melefish. And David again smote Aram of Damesek as well. Vayasem David nitzivim ba'aram Damesek. He put a garrison of forces in Damascus. Ati Aram leDavid la'avadim nosei mincha. And the Arameans became servants to David, bringing presents. Yosha shemet David b'chol asher alach. David was victorious in all. God made David victorious in all that he did. Vaykach David shilteya zahav asher ayu al avdei hadadezer. David took the gold shields that were on the servants of Hadadezer. V'yaviem Yerushalayim, he brought them to Yerushalayim, I would assume as part of the spoils of war. Umibetach, umiberotai, arei Hadadezer, and as far as the cities of Hadadezer, Betach and Berotai. Akach HaMelech David Nechoshet HaBemeot. David was able to take a great amount of brass, various spoils of war. Unclear what he does with them. We will explore that at a later time. Vayishmat Toi Melech Hamat. Toi, king of Hamat. Hamat, I showed you on the map. Hamat is all the way from here. Hamat, the northern part of this region, all the way up into Turkey. Let me just pull up the other map for a second. This is the area of Hamat, Beit Rehov, right? So this is the area of the war with Ammon, the war with Aram here in the Golan, and then all of this Hamat is all the way up into the area of Turkey. So Toi Melech Hamat is this region in the brown, up here, up to the Euphrates River. When Toi, king of Hamat, heard that David had smitten the king of Aram, namely Hadadezer, Vayishlach Toi et Yoram Benoel Hamelech David, Lish'olo l'shalom. So Toi sent his son Yoram, crown prince, to David to salute him, to greet him with blessings of peace, ulevarcho, and to bless him and to thank him, al asher nilcham b'Hadadezer v'yakeu, for having fought against Hadadezer and for having defeated him, ki ish milchamot Toi haya Hadadezer, because over the years, Hamat here and Hadadezer here were at war with each other. So if they're war with each other and David defeated Hadadezer, that means that, what's the old expression? Enemy of my enemy is my friend. David now has a new ally in the northern part of the country. He brought with him all kinds of vessels of silver and gold and brass. Gam otam mikdish ha-melech David la-Hashem im ha-kesef ha-zahav asher hikdish mikol ha-goyim ha-shekibesh. These gifts David also dedicated to God, with the gold and the silver and the brass that he had already taken from his other victories. Me'aram, u'me'moav, u'me'bnei Amon. What other victories are we talking about? A victory against Aram, victory against Moav, victory against Ammon, victory against the Plishtim, victory against Amalek, mi'plishtim u'me'amalek, u'mishlal hadadezer b'nochov melech Tzova, and the spoils of Hadadezer ben Rehob. So quite a significant list of all of the peoples that David had conquered over the years and the spoils of war that he dedicated to God in Yerushalayim. Aram, we've seen. Moab, we mentioned. Ammon was how the story began. Plishtim was back in the previous parak when he conquered Yerushalayim. And Amalek is the end of Sefer Shmuel where he battles against Amalek. So David has really kind of created this very vast empire of which subdued all of our enemies, and in so doing amassed a great fortune, which he dedicates to God, we will come back to. Vayas David Shem, b'shuvo mi'akotot Aram, b'gei melach, 18,000. David earned a name for himself when he returned from smiting Aram in Gei Melech, the Valley of Salt, 18,000 men. This Aram here is a little bit of a mystery. In fact, the split amongst the Mefarshim, whether it is in fact a reference to, let's see if I can pull it up quickly. Yeah, if you take a look at the Malbim, Mayas David Shem B'shuvo Mekotot Aram, U'bedivrei Hayamim Katuv, V'Avishai Ben Tzruya Hika'et Edom B'gei Melech Yudchet Elef. So it's unclear, and similarly in Tehillim, I'll show you this parak in a moment, Batsotot Aram Naraim V'yashov Yo'av V'yachet Edom B'gei Melech. So the Pasuk says Aram, but Gei Melech is down. I'll show you where Gei Melech is. Gei Melech is here, down in the area of Valley of Salt, the southern tip of the Dead Sea, is Gei Melech. Aram is not here. Edom is. So most Mefarshim suggest that this pasuk means that when David returned from his battle of Aram, he engaged whoever was in Gei Melech, and it happened to have been Edom, or this Aram is another name for Edom. Aram and Edom are very similar words, and right, Aresh and Adalet are easily interchangeable or exchangeable. And so it's possible that this should have been Edom and not Aram. I'm going to come back to that question, but for now, this battle is certainly battle against Edom. Vayasem be'edom, here you see it, it says it explicitly, nitzivim b'chol Edom, sam nitzivim, David put a garrison in of forces in Edom, vayi kol Edom avadim leDavid, and Edom became servants of David, vayosh Hashem et David b'chol asher halach. God enabled David's victories in everything that he did. David reigned over all of Israel, executed justice and righteousness for his people. Yoav ben Tzruya latzava. Yoav ben Tzruya was in charge of his army. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud mazkir. Yehoshaphat was his recorder. Tzadok ben Achitub v'Achimelech ben Aviatar Kohanim, two Kohanim Gdolim, Tzadok ben Achitub and Achimelech ben Aviatar. Usraya Sofer, and Sraya was his scribe. Ufanayahu ben Yoyada, Yakresi via Plesi. Yoyahu ben Yoyada was in charge of the Kreti and Pleti. We'll talk about what that is. Ufanay David Kohanim, Ayu, David's sons were. This word doesn't mean Kohanim in the sense of temple Kohanim, but meaning they were ministers in his lechaen, is to minister in some role. And so David's children served in his kingdom. That's the parak. And there's a lot of moving parts in this parak. And so to really get a sense of it, one of the things that we talked a little bit about, I want to do a quick review of where we left off before we explored the parak in detail. But one of the things that emerges is that this parak seems to jump from one story to another, unlike parak Yud, where the story of the Battle of Aram is given to us in great detail. Here it's kind of a couple of sentences in passing to describe how after the defeat of Hadadezer, Toi Melech Hamat came with spoils of war. And so it's kind of mentioned in passing, but it's clearly after the Battle of Aram. There are other battles mentioned here too. There are also phrases that keep popping up, Vayach. Vayachet Plishtim, he smote the Plishtim, Vayachet Moab, he smote Moab, Vayachet Hadadezer, he smote Hadadezer, Vayilkod David, and he captured the cities. Further down, you have...
Vayimelech.
Maram and Moab, all the names of all the cities. You also have the phrase of these cities, these nations that he conquered, paying tribute to David's kingdom, meaning paying taxes, being subjects of David's kingdom. You even have a pasuk here that repeats itself, that is written literally verbatim twice. God was with David in all of his victories and everything that he did. You have that pasuk again further up at the beginning of the parak. So when we start to take a step back and look at the structure of this parak, and I think I shared this with you once before, but I'll show you again. The easiest way to see this this whole story is to look at the parak from the vantage point of being almost a table of contents to all of David's battles. It's kind of a summary of David's campaign. And the easiest way to see that summary is to see the end of it. Right? The end of this parak is clearly psukim that are designed to be a kind of a closure on the world of David's Malchus. David reigned over Israel justly, righteously. Yoab ben Tzruya was in charge of the army. Yehoshaphat ben Ahiluv was his secretary. You have cabinet ministers, you have officers, you have scribes, you have kreti ve'apleti, which is probably a reference to foreign forces that were drafted into the Israelite army from the word kret and plishtim, kritim and plishtim, most likely. Some say it's a reference to Urim v'Tumim, but that's a different issue. But this is clearly a summary. And it's so much a summary that if you look at the end of, right, this is Perek Chet, right? If you look at, I'm just going to jump ahead for 1 second, to Perek Chaf, which is the last story in David's, in the world of David before, right, the rebellion of Avshalom. The rebellion of Avshalom ends with Avshalom's death and David returns to Yerushalayim, etc. And that's sort of the end of the story of David, because after that, there's a bunch of, almost an epilogue. There's 3 prakim or 4 prakim that are postscripts of much earlier events. So the story of David ends in Perek Chaf. And if you look at the end of that parak, you have exactly the same psukim. V'yav el kol tzava Yisrael, Yoav in charge of the army, v'neyav ben yoyada ala kreti v'ala pleiti, v'neyav ben yoyada in charge of the kreti pleiti, adaram ala mas, adaram was in charge of the taxes, Yehoshaphat ben Ahilud amazgir, Yehoshaphat ben Ahilud was the recorder, shva sofer, the names are a little different, but essentially you have a description of the different roles, the maskir, the sofer, Tzadok ve'evyatar kohanim, begam ira hayari ayakohen David, and that's your summary. So you have exactly the same summary at the end of Perek Chaf that you have at the end of Perek Chet. Yoab ben Tzruya al tzavav, Yehoshaphat ben Ahilud amazgir, v'tzadok ben Ahitub al sofer, v'neyav ben Yehuda al kreti v'al preti, v'nei David kohanim ayu. So that tells me that these are summary psukim. Now, why is David's world and story summarized, ended twice? That's an easy question to answer. Why does the story of David end here in Perek Chet and not in Perek Chaf? That's a relatively easy question to answer. Because everything from Perek Yud Aleph, where we finished, or really from Perek Yud, Yud Aleph, until Perek Chaf is part of what story?
The story of war, this one.
Well, this is the story of all of his campaigns, but from Perek Yud Aleph until the end of Perek Chaf is all one long story.
Bathsheba.
Right. It's a story of Bathsheba and its aftermath. So David's world can really be described in 2 arcs. The upward arc of his ascendance and reaching the pinnacle of his experience, reigning over the largest kingdom and the empire of sort of the superpower of David's world, and from the Bathsheba until the end of his life, which is the diminishing arc of his world. And so you have two summaries. You have a summary at the end of his ascendance, and you have a summary at the end of his end of his life, which is the end of the story of Bathsheba. So that's the trajectory of the arc of David's life. So this is really a summary. So that's what Parakhet is. Parakhet is a kind of a summary on the post-Yushalayim world of David. What has David accomplished? And he's accomplished quite a bit. Major battles. But in Siddur, we describe all of his battles. So here you have the list. This is what I've done in this chart, which I gave you once before, is I have literally pulled the parak out verbatim, meaning this is a copy-paste of the whole parak. All I've done is structured it. So I've taken the two key psukim, Vayosh Hashem David B'chol Asher Alach, which appears twice, and used them as anchor points to divide the parak into two parts. I've taken the phrase Vayach, which is all of the kingdoms or armies that David battled and was victorious over, and bolded them. Vayachat Plishtim, Vayachat Moav, Vayachat Hadad Ezer, Vayach David Ba'aram, Vayishmatu Melech Matki, Ka David at Hadad Ezer, and Vayakeu is a reference to the previous battle. And then, of course, Vayas David B'Shivo Mehakoto et Edom B'Gei Melech, his final battle against Edom. A list of all the nations that he fought, Plishtim, Moav, Hadad Ezer, Damesek, Aram, Toi Melech Hamat, Aram, Moab, Ammon, Plishtim, Amalek, Tsova, Edom. List of all of the places that he fought. So more or less, this parak reads like a table of contents to all of David's campaigns. Here is the book of David's military campaign. He smote A, B, C, D, E, F. It accomplished the following political aspirations and alliances. It brought the following amount of wealth and money into the treasuries of the court, which he dedicated to God in some fashion. And the two battles specifically mentioned here that aren't in Perek Yud are the battle against Moab and the battle against Edom. And otherwise, it's a summary of all that had been accomplished in David's world. So does that help put this parak into perspective? Right, it's a step back. For us, it's challenging because it's a step back that mentions all of the events of Perek Yud, but it's written two chapters before Perek Yud. So why would the Navi divide the story that way? Why would I take the entire experience of David in Aram and detail it only after this summary conclusion of David's world? Why are the chapters written in reverse order? And if this chapter was after chapter 10, I'd have no problem. Chapter 10 describes the battle, and then its aftermath, here's the summary. He made peace with Toi Melech Hamat, and he smote Moab and Ammon, cleanup campaigns, and this is the end of David's life. If it went Perek Yud and then Perek Chet, easy.
So is this showing, Rabbi, that God forgave David? That he did tshuva?
For what?
For the sin of Bathsheba.
Bathsheba hasn't happened yet.
Oh, I thought we said that it did.
No. Don't misunderstand me. What I'm suggesting is the summary of David's life is mentioned here. It's mentioned again at the end of the story of Bathsheba to show me that these are sort of two summary points in his life. But the story of Bathsheba doesn't happen until after, right, until chapter 11. Let me just put this in perspective. This is chapter 10. Chapter 10 ends with the battle of Aram. Right?
Yeah.
We're going to explore this again when we study the story of Bathsheba. But the next pasuk, beginning of chapter 11, is Vayilu Tshuvat Hashanah Le'etz Het HaMelechim Veishlach David Et Yoav Et Avadav Imo Et Kol Yisrael VeYashchitu Et Bnei Amon. David, in the aftermath of the battle with Aram, sends Yoav back to Ammon, to the city of Ammon, to Rabbah, to besiege it and to defeat it. And that campaign takes a year long. Vayatsuru al Rabbah, to besiege Rabbah, the capital of Ammon, for a year. V'David Yosheb Yerushalayim, and there David sat that one out. He stayed in Yerushalayim. David He can't sleep one night. He walks up to the top of his temple, of his palace. He's walking on the rooftop. He sees Bathsheba, and as we say, the rest is history. Bathsheba is post the Battle of Aram. You with me?
Yeah.
Now, that already is the answer in part to my question. Why is the chapters out of order? I think they're out of order because the story of David is divided in the Sefer. The Navi divides the story into two parts. Let's call it the positive and the negative. Right? All that was good and pure and encouraging and hopeful and enlightening and David sitting on the top of the world, literally conquering every region, every nation, expanding the borders, expanding the power, the wealth, the depth, David preparing the Beit HaMikdash, everything up until Perek Chet, the battle against the Plishtim, the conquest of Yerushalayim, the request to build the temple, the conquest of the Aramean armies of the north, the peace with Toi Melech Hamat, expanding the borders up to the Euphrates, everything is pure and beautiful. Even the wealth that he achieves in the and that he amasses, which is extraordinary, goes to the temple. Everything up in the Perek Chet is pristine. And that's where the summary takes place. The end of David's life, it's pristine. Vayosha Hashem et David b'chol asher alach. God was with David in everything he did, assisted him, helped him, enabled him to accomplish this extraordinary feat. That's Perek Chet. Now, in so doing, we mentioned two key battles, one against Ammon, one against Hadadezer, meaning the battle against Aram, and the other we'll see Ammon and Moab and Edom. But all of that is part of the successful campaign of David. Then we turn our attention to the next part of the story, which starts all over again. It starts in Perek Tet with Mephibosheth. And if you remember the story of Mephibosheth, Mephibosheth is introduced to us here because we need him later in the story of the rebellion of Avshalom. So we need to know who he is. But the story of Mephibosheth isn't necessarily David's finest hour, because David, as much as he's kind to Mephibosheth here, kind of fails him later on. Perek Yud is the story of the battle of Ammon and Aram again, but from the vantage point of where David participates and where he doesn't participate. Much more detail. He sends Yoav to deal with Aram, with Ammon. Yoav gets into trouble. David goes and he takes care of Aram himself. He comes back to Yerushalayim. He sends Yoav back to take care of Ammon. Next, we have the story of Bathsheba. Perek Yud continues into the story of Bathsheba. And so everything from Perek Tet and on is a trajectory towards the story of Bathsheba and, if you will, David's downfall. And his rise from it as well, his ability to fall and to rise up, which is a theme we'll come to in depth when we study Bathsheba. But everything from Perek Chet is, it's not about failure and success, Chet and Tshuva, it's about success. It's about David's, the pristine of David, the ascendance of David, both physically, militarily, and spiritually. And that's sort of the role that Perek Chet plays. Okay. Any questions on that? Does this structure help understand what's going on in this Perek? I think I actually, I mean, all the source pages get posted on the shul website. I may have sent them out by email, but this is part of that list of sources that'll be posted. You'll have it. You can take a look at it. It's easier to see in color, which is why in black and white it doesn't always come out. But clearly this is, I'm going to actually just expand it to the whole page. You can see the list of cities or peoples that David conquers is the first half of the parak. Vayachat plishtim, vayachat moa, vayachat moa, hadadeza, vayach ba'aram, vayosha Hashem et David. Number of peoples that David conquers successfully. Then we have three psukim, Zion, Chet, Tet, Yud, Yudala, five psukim that deal with the alliances, the aftermath of the war, but the alliances that David creates and the spoils of war that David collects out of it. So from Shiltei HaZahav that he took on the armies of soldiers of Hadadezer, and the alliance with Toi Melech Hamat that brought much Kesef HaZahav, Klei Nechoshet, much gold and silver and money into the treasuries of David. And all of them, David is dedicating to God. Gam otam ikdish ha-melech David la-Hashem. Whatever he does with these spoils, he kdish la-Hashem, he brings to Yerushalayim. What he does with them in Yerushalayim, we will explore. He brings to Yerushalayim and he dedicates them to God. So that speaks to the, again, to that pristine, to that pure, to the motivation, that he's not taking it to line his pockets or to establish the wealth and power of his kingdom. On the contrary, even horses that he captures, instead of building an army of chariots, which is what Shlomo does, he follows the command of the Torah, which is to hamstring the horses, so he can't be tempted to use them as an army of horses and chariots. Mitzusehem te'akeh. And he does that here too. And two additional battles that are mentioned here as kind of a postscript or mentioned by the by, and those are the two campaigns that we're going to continue to explore a little bit more in detail. One is the Battle of Moab, and someone mentioned before the cruelty of hamstringing the horses. The Battle of Moab seems to be even more complex. It seems to be an arbitrary decision as to who lives and who dies. And the Battle of Edom. And those are the two parts of this campaign that are not mentioned in Perek Yud, but I mentioned in Perek Chet, and we'll need to kind of put them all together. Questions?
I have a question about why did David take this year out? He had been doing so well. So why did he decide that he needs a rest or something and takes a whole year out and doesn't go to any battles?
So that's an excellent question, but it's relevant to the story of Bathsheba. So I'm going to hold it, park it, and table it for our study of Perek Yud Aleph. It's actually one of the key questions in the story of Bathsheba. And we will, which is on my agenda, probably. I'll already tell you the schedule. My goal is to finish all of the loose ends, if you will, up until this part of the story through, probably till Shavuos. I don't think I want to start the story of Bathsheba this year because we're only going to have one or two classes, and that will be, sort of hard to start and stop. And so my goal is to do the entire story of Bathsheba and the rebellion of Avshalom. That will be the agenda for Mirtz Hashem once we start up again in the fall. So that's my plan. Okay. So now let's turn our attention. So now that we have a kind of a bird's eye view of this perek, everybody have a understand what I'm trying to convey in this perek? I want to focus on specifically the two campaigns that are mentioned here that are not mentioned in the previous story, and that is the Battle of Moab and the Battle of Edom. So let's start with Moab. Vayachad Moab, וימדדם בחבל השכב אותם ארצה. וימדד שני חבלים להמית ומלוא החבל להחיות. David smote Moab, measured them with a line, forced them to lie down on the ground, measured two lines to put to death, one line to keep alive, and then Moab became servants of David, bringing him presents, paying tribute, taxes, etc. That is followed by Vayach David et Hadadezer. There's a lot to be said about this campaign against Moab. But let's start with the obvious question, which is,
why did he have to kill so many people?
Yeah, it sounds like an element of cruelty I would not have anticipated in David's arsenal.
Rabbi, does that relate to him losing his family to Moab?
So we're going to get to that issue. That is certainly a possibility. We're going to look at that. So in the midst of all of this, we have this story of Moab. Let's actually take a look at that in the Mefarshim. Vayach et Moav, vayimadadem b'chevel hashkim otam arza, vayimadaded shnei chavalim lamit. This description of him, the conquest of Moab, sounds almost like he defeats them and then he executes them, or he defeats them and defeats two-thirds of them in an arbitrary line of who is
Rabbi, how do we know that
two-thirds?
How do we know it's more than just he's killing women and children, not just the soldiers of Moab from this pasuk?
I don't. Which is why it's very strange. It's not clear what this rope is. So some suggest it's an arbitrary execution. Again, which I'm somewhat uncomfortable with. Is it possible? Yes. I'm uncomfortable with it. So let's take a look at the Mefarshim. So let's start with the Radak. Vayimadadem b'chevel hashkim otam arza. Lie them on the ground, measure them by the rope. Two-thirds. Derech nekama ubizayon. Kegem Yonatan, chaval avda kloma goral v'chelak. The chevel on the ground, says the Targum, is like a goral. It's like a lot. Derech nekama ubizayon, as a form of vengeance and embarrassment, shame. Why would Yosef Kara also mishum boshet, shame? It seems to be a consistent pattern amongst the Mefarshim that this is an act of vengeance. Why an act of vengeance against against Moab? So the Radak jumps to a midrash. We've seen this midrash before. I actually put it on the source page as well, so you have it on the source page. The Radak says the following. V'yamu midrash, ki asa ze ba'avur shehemitu aviv v'imo v'echav. David was doing this, says the midrash, out of count as an act of vengeance to punish Moab for the execution of David's family. When did Moab execute David's family? Kishenacha otam be'eretz Moab, kishyabarech mipnei Shaul. Because once, when David was first fleeing from Shaul's wrath, the first step he did, recognizing that after the destruction of the city of Nov, David realized that Shaul was going to execute anybody who had any contact with David. So he took his family, who was living in Bethlehem, and he hid them. Where did he hide them? So he hid them Be'eretz Moav. As it says, Vayinachem et pnei melech Moav, that he intentionally went to the king of Moav and sought asylum for his family there. Why Moab? Moab is an enemy. Why would you go to Moab? Why would you take your family and deposit them by Moab for safekeeping?
Moab is an enemy of Israel.
Excuse me?
Last place Shaul would go looking for
right. him. So it's the last place Shaul would go to look for them because Shaul has a territory, right? Shaul's kingdom doesn't include Moab. Moab is outside the territorial boundaries of Malchut Shaul. Malchut Shaul is the purple. Moab is over here. So David crosses over the river and he deposits his family, the king of Moab. Here's Yerushalayim. Here's Beit Lechem. It's not hard to see. He takes his family and he crosses over the Yarden with them and he deposits them in with the king of Moab for safekeeping. You watch over my family. Ukishi yatzad David misham ve'alach le'ir. Chamat, when David left there and journeyed to the next city, Harag Melech Moav Aviv V'Imo V'Echav. Moav, king of Moav, went and he executed all of David's family. Now, how do we know that? So we don't. No, it doesn't tell us this in the text. Here's the text itself. I'll show you what it says. It says, "Vayelach David misham mitzpe Moav." From as he's running away from David, "Vayelach David misham vayimaleh tamarat adulam." He's running away from David, from Shaul. "Vayelach David misham mitzpe Moav." "Vayomer Melech Moav yetzena avi veimi itchem ad asher eda ma yaseh li Elokim." Let my father and mother and family stay by you until I know what God's destiny is for me. "Vayanchem et pnei Melech Moav." He left them and in the protection of the king of Moab. Vayeshvu imo ko yemei hayot David bamtsuda. And there they dwelt all the days that David was in the fortress. What's the mystery? Says Rashi, lo matzinu sheyetzu misham. We have no reference ever that David goes back to collect his family to bring them to Yerushalayim. Never. We don't have any reference. Now, it's possible, text doesn't tell us everything that David ever did, right? But it's significant enough that David takes his family to Moab, but it's not significant enough to tell us that he went to Moab to bring his father and mother and family back to safety after he emerges as king. And so that absence, Chazal say, is an indication that David, in fact, did not go back to collect his family because the king of Moab killed them all. And then the Medrash adds one twist, which is that one brother escaped. Chutz me'echad shebarach. Why is it important to tell us that one brother escaped? Number one, so he knows what happened. Right? There's a testimony, there's an aid to the story. And number two, v'hechiyahu nachash ha'amoni. And he ran to, like this brother who escaped, ran from Moab to Ammon, up here along the edge. From Moab to Ammon, and he sought asylum by the king of Ammon by the name of Nachash. V'hu hachesed she'amar David kasher asah aviv imadi chesed. Perek Yud began when David wanted to pay a shiva call, if you will, to the king of Ammon when his father Nachash had died. So that story began. If you remember, beginning of Perek Yud, the king of Ammon, namely Nachash, had died. Chanun, his son, had taken over. David im Chanun ben Nachash kasher aviv imadi chesed. I will be kind to Chanun ben Nachash as his father Nachash was kind to me. And it never tells us where this kindness, what this kindness was. So the Midrash strings together these two pieces of the story. Ammon, David's family is sitting in Moab. We don't know what happened to them. We have a mysterious chesed that the king of Ammon does for David. Let's assume one is connected to the other. David's family was killed. One survived, went to Hanun, to Nachash, and Nachash protected him. Again, it's a midrashic approach to filling in the missing details of two parts of the story that are confusing. That's the Medrash, and that's the story. So it's an attempt to explain the cruelty of David, Vayimadadem b'chevel, and why was David so cruel to them? Because it was an act of vengeance for having killed his family. And if you look at all the Mefarshim, Yosef Kara Lefisha, Hemitu et Echav, Kishenichemet Pne Malach Moav. Shnei Shlish Hayareg, he killed two thirds of them. All the Mefarshim basically take this approach. As I'm sure you can detect in my voice, I'm somewhat uncomfortable with the notion that in the midst of all of this perek, that David would have turned to Moab as an act of personal vengeance. That does not sound like David-isk. Personal vengeance. He won't lift a finger against Shaul, even though Shaul is actively trying to kill him. And yet here he'll take an entire nation and decimate them because of personal vengeance for something they did to his family. It's possible. I'm not saying it's not possible. It is certainly possible. I'm just uncomfortable with it. So I'm looking for an alternative interpretation, possibly, that would explain why suddenly in the midst of all of this, we have a reference to Moab. It also is somewhat odd on the map. If you look at the map, he's up here in the north, Aram, and suddenly he's down here in the south, in Moab. That's also weird. So maybe the whole campaign is over and everybody's gone home and everything's settled. And so he turns to Moab and he deals with Moab for an old crime that has nothing to do with our story. Right? How many opportunities did he have until now to deal with Moab? He holds a grudge from them for all those decades from the time that they killed his family. And now, now he's got the power. He's going to deal with Moab. To divorce the story of Moab from any context of the Battle of Aram is hard, especially when you see it literally sandwiched into this list of campaigns. V'yachad Moab, v'yachad Hadadezer, and v'yachad Edom. So I'm left with a bit of a mystery here. Add to that the cruelty that seems to be for a personal vengeance is hard to swallow. So I'm going to leave this with a question. We're going to pick up from here next week, Bezrat Hashem, on Vayachad Moav, and see if we can't navigate through this sequence of battles in a way that would put the story of Moav into a context of the rest of the parak. So that is our agenda, our goal for next week.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.